Well, hello. I'm Zach Stone. I'm a PhD student here in SEAS working with Todd Zickler on face recognition, and I'm here to tell you about Hadoop. So you might wonder, well, what is Hadoop? And we're obviously going to get into this in a lot more detail, but at the very highest level, Hadoop distributes data and computation across a large number of computers. That's it. So here's a quick outline for what I'm planning to cover. So first, you might wonder, well, why should I care about Hadoop? Why do I care about distributing data and computation across a large number of computers? I'll try and answer that first to give this talk some motivation. Next, I'll go to say what exactly Hadoop is. Turns out it's a whole ecosystem of tools. I'll give you an overview of Hadoop MapReduce, which is kind of the underlying algorithm behind this framework. I'll briefly mention the Hadoop Distributed File System, which goes by the acronym HDFS. I'll give you some of my experience with Hadoop's advantages and disadvantages, tell you how to get started, and then present some useful resources at the end. So first of all, why on earth should you care? Well, the main idea is that there is lots of data everywhere. And this is a really new phenomenon. The plummeting cost of storage and the increasing amounts of computational power available mean that it's possible to capture and store a larger amount of data than ever before. And there are all sorts of benefits, potentially, from analyzing this data. But to approach data sets on the petabyte scale requires new tools, and that's what Hadoop is about. So just to gather some examples from the media, I've been browsing some news articles, and this article jumped out at me from the New York Times recently called Data Center Overload. The fact that really surprised me is that data centers now are estimated to use somewhere between 1 and 2% of the world's electricity. Now, that's kind of an astonishing number. 1 to 2% of all electricity used is to power big data centers that are working with large data sets computationally. Surprising. So where is all that power going? Well, these are just pretty pictures. But these are showing you servers in racks, cables, cooling systems, power supplies, and more. This is the guts of the internet, the web, large-scale computing. These are the servers that you're talking to every day when you use Google or Facebook or Yahoo or any other online product. And so there's just lots of data. There's data accumulating at an accelerating rate. And you might wonder then, well, why Hadoop for big data? Okay, you believe there's all this data, but why this particular tool? Well, Hadoop is the most credible open source tool set for large scale, general purpose computing. There are many other approaches to parallel computing, and in particular, if you're going to be working with scientific computing or doing very fast graphics processing at something like Pixar, Hadoop may not be the right fit. But if you want a very flexible framework to experiment with a general purpose program, say you want to process logs from a very large website, or say you want to do operations on a large number of photographs, Hadoop is really the only game in town, at least in the open source world. Now, Hadoop is backed by Yahoo, Cloudera, and other companies, which is one of the reasons that it's a very high quality product. It's used and contributed to by Facebook as well, among others. And it's getting increasing support from Amazon's web services. Now, the benefit to you is that that gives you yet another way to interact with the Hadoop software. You don't actually have to install it yourself. You can use it by the hour on Amazon's Elastic Compute Cloud, for example. Now, you might wonder, well, what about Google? I haven't said much about Google. And in some sense, Google is the pioneer of this approach to large-scale computing. Hadoop is an open source imitation of the distributed MapReduce platform that was developed by Google. Now, map and reduce as programming concepts date back, you know, decades to functional programming languages. The idea of MapReduce in this new large-scale context, though, is to take the same idea of functional programming, which I'll get into later, of mapping a function onto a large number of data values, but to do that in a robust way across a large number of machines that's tolerant to various kinds of failures that you encounter with large machine systems. So Google doesn't use Hadoop, but Google uses the MapReduce infrastructure that inspired Hadoop. So those are sort of interchangeable when I talk about it. So the short answer is, why would you use Hadoop? Well, Hadoop processes petabytes daily right now. It's still under active development, and as you're using it, you'll find it still feels a lot like alpha software sometimes, but it works, and it works at large scale. Just as a quick example of that, here's a benchmark that Yahoo performs every so often, which is sort of a raw speed test of how the Hadoop framework is doing. And in this case, Hadoop is sorting a petabyte. Now, that's an enormous amount of data. A petabyte on Yahoo's cluster of something like 1,400 nodes, so 1,400 individual computers, in under a day, in just 16.25 hours. Now, I don't know. I don't really have a feel for a petabyte, but a terabyte, a smaller, much smaller unit, you can buy a hard drive now that contains a terabyte worth of data. And so you might ask, well, how quickly can Hadoop sort a terabyte? And the answer to that is it can sort a terabyte in just 62 seconds, about a minute flat. Now, if you think about random strings distributed in a terabyte worth of data, sorting those into some kind of ordering in under a minute, pretty astonishing. And so this is another reason that Hadoop is the most credible implementation of MapReduce at scale out there. Now, before I proceed, though, I should give you a really important disclaimer. If the data and computation you use require more than one machine, if you have more data that can fit on an array of hard drives inside a machine, or if you have to do more computation than one machine can do in a reasonable amount of time, Hadoop is a great fit. But if the problem that you're trying to solve does fit on one machine, if all the data, all the computation, you could just buy a big enough machine to do it on one machine, that's going to be incredibly simpler than working with the Hadoop infrastructure. Now, as you can see here from this visualization I've put together, Hadoop is complicated. It's getting easier to use. The rough spots are getting smoothed slowly, but it's a very complicated machine. Now, I don't know if you can guess from this patent diagram what this machine is supposed to do, but I'll tell you the answer. This is a machine that was patented to change a single light bulb. Now, my point in showing you this, I added the elephant, by the way, but my point in showing you this is use the right tool for the job, and sometimes some tools are more complicated than what you need. I'll save the how many Harvard students it takes to change a light bulb jokes for later. So that's why what Hadoop is and why you should care. But I want to move on to tell you, well, okay, suppose you believe it. Hadoop is the right tool to use for big data. What big data sets are interesting? Well, as I've alluded to along the way, Google, Amazon, Facebook, Netflix, Yahoo, all these companies whose products we use are working with enormous data sets, petabytes worth of data, whether it's the entire web, Google has multiple copies of the web, whether it's also Gmail, Google Maps, all those are extraordinarily large data sets. Facebook, you might think, well, Facebook, what is it? Just a few profile photos and some structured text. Well, Facebook is the largest photo sharing site on the web, so they have 20 billion of our photographs, and they have to work with those and serve them up in a reasonable way and resize them to the appropriate sizes. And while that would be easy to do in small pieces, it's very difficult to do at large scale. They also have to do things behind the scenes to keep spammers off the site and measure traffic and make predictions and all this kind of stuff, even if you don't see it, is large-scale computation. Same for Yahoo with the search engine, Netflix trying to predict movie ratings, Amazon.com trying to decide, well, if you liked Harry Potter, what else might you like? And suggest that to you to maximize revenues. But it's not all corporations who are working with big data sets. The new administration on the site called data.gov has committed to making publicly available as many data sets as it reasonably can. So this means satellite imagery, this means crime statistics, this means information about parks and recreation, roadmaps. I mean, anything that the government collects, census data, population data, they're trying to make available in a machine-readable form for the public, folks like you, to remix in interesting applications. So check out data.gov for inspiration for your final projects. Now that so much of the news is online, news, blogs, you can do interesting measurements of how news actually travels through the blogosphere and through traditional media. This project, which you can experiment with at memetracker.org, looked at sentence fragments propagating across the web during the recent presidential election. And you can see here, lipstick on a pig turned out to be the largest spike, but you can track several others, and this allows people to measure. If you can work with millions and millions of blog posts, it allows people to measure, well, does traditional media lead the blogs? Do some blogs lead the traditional media? And reason about the way news travels. Maybe you're interested in sports. Well, in the near future, at least in baseball, there are going to be increasingly sophisticated systems deployed that will keep track at every instant of the game of where the ball is, where the players are, and how they're interacting. And so what this means is a game that's already very heavy on statistics will have the potential to compute new statistics about interactions that haven't even been named yet, about the way a particular player responds to a particular kind of hit. And so there's a gold mine here for sports statisticians to work with big data sets of games that will get recorded into the future. So maybe you think, well, okay, that's fine, but all this is kind of cutting edge stuff. What about groceries? Well, Tesco is one of the largest British grocers, and they actually use models of the weather and large data sets from their own sales to predict what products need to be available in what quantities in the future. And my favorite line here was that the system successfully predicted temperature drops during July that led to a major increase in demand for soup, winter vegetables, and cold weather puddings. Well, the UK is different, but I think the same techniques can be useful here. So finally, just to further explain why I think this is worth learning, is there's a lot of demand that's currently unmet in the commercial world and in government and in the academic world for people who know how to work with these increasingly large data sets. The Times has been running a series of pieces. This one, for today's graduate, just one word, statistics. It used to be plastics, but now it's statistics and big data. And this article features a Harvard grad, actually. And even more recently, training to climb an Everest of digital data. And the important line here is that it's a rare criticism of elite American university students that they do not think big enough. But that's exactly the complaint from some of the largest technology companies and the federal government. Basically, there aren't enough people who know how to work with big data sets. And that's what this talk is about. So next, on our outline, I'm going to tell you a little bit more about what exactly Hadoop is. And it turns out, it's not just one thing, it's not just one program, it's actually an ecosystem of programs. Founded, in a sense, by this fellow called Doug Cutting, who started the project. It's an open source project. And you might wonder, where does this whimsical name Hadoop come from? Well, Doug's child, his son, I think, has a stuffed elephant, a little stuffed animal. And his son called the elephant Hadoop. And so all the good names were taken. And so Doug decided, well, I'll call my open source project Hadoop. And the name stuck. And so that's inspired a whole set of whimsical complements to Hadoop. Hive is a database-like layer built on top of Hadoop. HBase is another database-like layer on top of Hadoop. There's Zookeeper. There's Chukwa. There's Avro. And the number of sub-projects around Hadoop is growing all the time, but today I'm only going to focus on the two main components, namely Hadoop MapReduce and HDFS, the distributed file system. So first, we're going to go to MapReduce. Now you might be used to this paradigm of computing, which I'm going to metaphorically represent with a single elephant. Now, this is the paradigm in which you're working with one computer. Now, that computer could be a laptop, it could be an iPhone, it could be a server in a data center somewhere, but you're used to executing a single program, maybe with threading, maybe with multiprocessing, but even that's relatively recent. The traditional model of computing is a fast processor is executing steps in order, and you're in complete control of everything that's going on. If the program fails, it fails catastrophically. You stop, debug, run it again. And so that's how programming has been done until relatively recently. Hadoop is a different model. Now, Hadoop is more like working with a herd of elephants here. Now, here, typically each elephant could represent either a core in a multi-core computer or an actual node, if you have thousands of computers, or a core on a node where there are thousands of nodes. It doesn't really matter. From this perspective, the point is you're trying to give instructions and control a large group of reasonably independent entities to carry out your computation for you. So, unfortunately, it's not as simple even as this. It's more like this little cartoon that I've put together here. Let's see. Here. So, in this little diagram, these elephants are blindfolded. Those are supposed to be blindfolds, not sunglasses. And they have earmuffs, so they can't hear very well. So they can't communicate with you very frequently or at all. And they can't communicate with each other. They're all operating independently as if none of the other elephants exists. And this is the case where you have many computers, little communication, and inevitably failures are going to occur. No equipment is 100% reliable. And if you have a large enough set of any kind of equipment, some components are always going to be broken. So the hardest part about distributed systems like this is the partial failure, that machines might be just beginning to fail and be 10 times slower than the rest. Those are the stragglers. Machines could be just wrong, wandering off in the wrong direction. They could go down, they could come back up and not realize that they had fallen apart. There are all these new failure modes that you're not accustomed to from the traditional world that I showed you before. And so this problem is what Hadoop is designed to solve. So the algorithm with which Google and now many others have attacked this problem is a generalization of MapReduce from the functional programming world. And MapReduce actually has three phases: map, sort, or often called shuffle, and reduce. Sort somehow didn't make it into the name. So first I'm going to tell you about the map phase. Now, I'm mixing two things here, so let me just be a little careful to separate them. So the MapReduce algorithm is about distributing data across a large number of computers, performing computations on that data on those computers, and then collecting results back together. The way that that's approached in this MapReduce framework is by restricting the programming model dramatically, restricting what programmers are allowed to do. And so what I'm about to describe here is the programming model. It's the way that you express a program to the Hadoop framework or to any MapReduce framework, and then that program gets carried out across all these different machines. So there's the physical implementation and there's the logical way of thinking about it, and so it's important to keep those distinctions in mind. So from a logical point of view, when you're working with this cluster of blindfolded elephants, your programs only specify operations on key value pairs. Excuse me, now what does that mean? So a key value pair could be anything. Typically in the Hadoop world, the key is some string and the value is some other string. Now this could be a very large value. It could be some kind of binary string that represents an image. The key could also be some arbitrary binary string, but for simplicity right now, let's just think of these as text strings. And each input pair can get mapped to zero or more output pairs. So it's key values coming in and key values going out in this map phase of the computation. So the reason this restriction is so useful is because each elephant, you know, computer, core, whatever you think about, is working on an independent input pair without knowing that the other elephants exist. There's no communication here. This pair just gets handed to one of the computers, and the computer says, oh great, I'm going to process this pair and emit these keys and values back. And that's it. So that cuts out all this enormous computational burden of trying to synchronize nodes, trying to manage communication among them, even as nodes are dropping out, coming back up, and all the kinds of failures that companies like Google see at really large scales. So as I go through these abstract definitions of map and reduce, I'm going to walk you through an example as well. So one of the classic examples for map reduce is the word count. And so here's how this works. Imagine you have a document. It could be anything, just, you know, the complete works of Shakespeare. But in this case, for this example, let's say it's a really basic screenplay that only has two lines. The file says, hello there. Why hello? That's it. One, two. Now, assume that those lines get broken up. The file gets broken up by line like this. And you get some key that doesn't really matter. Maybe it's a line number, you know, line one, line two. And then the value is each line, like this. So the way to think about this is the Hadoop framework handles the input for you. You hand it this screenplay, it cuts it up into lines and produces these key value pairs. You write the code, then, that splits these values up into new key value pairs. Y, 1, hello, 1, in this case. You're getting a count of 1 for each word in each line. And similarly up here, hello there gets split up into hello, one, there, one. This all happens independently, and at the end of the map phase you have this list, and I'll tell you how it's stored later in the distributed file system, but you have this list of key value pairs that can then be passed on to the shuffle phase and to the reduce phase. So next, let me tell you about this sort or shuffle phase. So what happens here is that all of these key value pairs that have been produced by a large number of tasks running in parallel get sorted such that all of the key value pairs with the same key get brought together. So in this case, we have key 1, key 1, key 1 with these three values. Those are all grouped together. Here we have key 2, key 2, key 2 with all these values. Those are grouped together. So in the word count example, this might look something like this. There's a distributed sort algorithm that all of these blindfolded elephants do to take the output that you saw before and group it into these colored boxes. Hello, one. Hello, one. There, one. And why, one. Now, you can imagine if this were the complete works of Shakespeare, there would be a much larger number of these boxes, and each word would appear many more times, typically. But this is just an example. Now, what's going to happen next is the reduce phase. And in this reduce phase, what happens is these keys that were all in a single box get handed to what's called a single reducer, which runs code, again, that you write in this case, to condense, typically. Reducers can generate an arbitrary number of key value outputs, but typically you have a large data set here and you're reducing it down to a smaller one. And the classic example, of course, is the word count, where one reducer gets the hello box and reduces hello one to hello two. These get passed through because there's no aggregation to be done. And what we have is what we wanted at the beginning, which is a complete set of statistics on how frequently each word appears in our corpus. 2, 1, 1. So you might think, okay, this is great, but what does this look like in code? Well, here's an example of a MapReduce program in Python. And this is actual code. Now, you can interact, Hadoop is written in Java, but you can interact with it from a variety of languages through standard input and output. I prefer Python. And the code here actually carries out this word count that I've just been demonstrating to you. So what does that mean? Well, instead of the usual thing where you have all this set up, you're in complete control, you write the program from start to finish, all you do is you write these functions, the mapper and the reducer, that take key value pairs to key value pairs. So take a look here. The mapper takes a key and a value as input. Here this might be line number and a line. And it says for word in value.split in Python, all that means is let's split the value, which is the line, into its constituent words. And then for each word in that list, we're going to yield, which is a fancy way of returning as a generator, we're going to yield a new key value pair, word and one. That's like the hello one there one counts that I was showing you before. That's what's going to be coming out of this mapper. And second, in this reducer here, Hadoop does all the shuffling around and juggling, and then the Python interface does all this wrapping, so you get a key, which is the word, like hello, and a generator of values. So even if you have more values than can fit in memory, you can pull them one at a time and count them up. And so in this case, I don't worry about that. Some pulls in all the values at once. If you had a very large set of values, you'd have to be a little more careful. But you yield the key, which might be hello, and the sum of the values, which might be 2 in the case that I showed you before. So this is it. This is real code that you could feed into the MapReduce framework. Now, if you're like me, you're thinking, oh man, this seems like way too much work for a word count. I mean, in my favorite programming language, I could write the word count from scratch in just a few lines. And, you know, that's true for most languages. So why? Why bother with all of this complexity of MapReduce? Well, here's why. Imagine you want to do word count on the entire web, billions and billions of web pages, and you want to know how often the word platypus appears. Well, your little program that you wrote in 3 lines is just not going to run on billions of web pages in a reasonable amount of time. And this isn't an abstract concern either, because Google, for example, actually has a copy of all of those billions of web pages. And the word count that we've been working on here, even though it seems kind of trivial, is actually closely related to the kinds of steps you would do for indexing, if you wanted to build an index that maps words to web pages on which they appear. And an index is one of the basic components that allows you to do web search, which is very useful and valuable. So Google initially developed this MapReduce framework at scale to solve its problems processing extremely large data sets in the early days. And so here's the famous paper, MapReduce, Simplified Data Processing on Large Clusters, that kind of sparked interest in this simplified programming model for extremely large data sets, and that inspired Hadoop. So just to summarize, the main advantage of working with Hadoop is that this very same code that I showed you before, if you feed it into the Hadoop framework, in principle could run on the entire web without modification. There's some complexity in actually getting that to work, but this is the main idea. So next on our outline, I'm going to tell you about the Hadoop distributed file system, because so far I've ignored where the data comes from and where the data goes. In particular, where do those key value pairs come from in the map phase? And in these intermediate phases for the sort and the shuffle, where are they stored? And when they're emitted, what happens to them? Well, it turns out that Hadoop, while it can work with other file systems, is built on top of something called this Hadoop Distributed File System, HDFS. And what HDFS does is it takes a really large, in fact, arbitrarily large amount of data, chops it up into little pieces, and distributes those pieces on nodes, which in this case think of as servers. So each yellow box here is a separate computer. And these blue boxes inside are chunks of this big data set. And now, I haven't tried to illustrate it here, but an individual chunk, say this lower right corner of the data, might actually be replicated on several different machines. In fact, the default in HDFS is for each one of these chunks to be replicated 3 times on separate machines, which is one of the main properties of the system that provides for robustness. So that means if this machine goes away, and I'll say more about this later, but if this machine goes away, you still have copies of each of these chunks on 2 other machines. And you can detect the failure, initialize a new server, and start copying those chunks over to get back up to your desired number of 3 copies each. And so just to complete the pipeline from before, the data is getting served out of HDFS. These chunks are getting pulled out, broken up by the framework into records or lines those look like the keys and values before. Those get passed to the blindfolded elephants, and the blindfolded elephants in between, I'm not showing it here, during this map produce process are writing back to HDFS. So there are lots of ways you could think about doing it, but there are a lot of great advantages about things working this way. In particular, you can deal with arbitrarily large data sets. You don't have to think about where to put the data. You just pour data into HDFS, and behind the scenes, the system is chunking it up and distributing the chunks across computers. And when it comes time to do computations on the data, the computation is local to the data. Because these yellow boxes are not independent from the computation. You're not moving data around to compute with it, typically. Typically, the computations are running on the boxes. So the Hadoop framework is smart enough to figure out, okay, this particular mapper should be, you know, moved over here and run on this set of data chunks. And so all of that happens locally. Now, not all computations obviously can be expressed this way. And so one of the big problems with the MapReduce framework is it makes it difficult to express problems that require what are known in the database world as joins. When you have one data set here of records, another data set here of records, and you want to match these records up by some criteria. That's often a real challenge in a framework like this because all of those records are stored on different machines that can't communicate with each other, and so you have to find a clever way of manipulating this framework to force it to fit those kinds of tasks. But it is possible. So, furthermore, as I'll talk about at the end, because all of this happens in parallel, you don't require any communication. Those elephants don't talk to each other. These data nodes typically don't talk to each other, although they do in a limited fashion. You don't control it as the programmer. You can really just think about computations from this logical, high-level point of view of key-value pairs mapped to key-value pairs. And once again, the inspiration for HDFS comes from Google. At Google, it's called GFS, the Google File System, and this is what Google runs underneath their implementation of MapReduce. So Google's MapReduce and GFS are the inspiration and analogs of Hadoop and HDFS. So now, from my own experiences working with Hadoop, I'm going to try and summarize the advantages and disadvantages that I've seen so far. So, first of all, there are many advantages, and I've alluded to some of these along the way. You're distributing data and computation. In some previous approaches to parallel programming, it's been typical to distribute the computation. You know, if you're doing scientific programming or something, working with large matrices, it might be that the processing pipeline is very CPU heavy, but the matrices, while large, aren't that large, right? And so you can afford to send individual components of data out to a grid of machines, run the computation there, and then send all of the data back. Hadoop is really designed to different criteria. It's designed for a world in which the data sets are so large that they can't fit on a single machine, and that you really don't want to be pushing them back and forth over the network just for transient computations to be done. So Hadoop distributes the data once and for all, and then distributes the computation to take place as much as possible where the data naturally lies. So that's a change in thinking that's proved very useful for these large-scale web data sets. So this, as I've mentioned, avoids network overload and provides for greater parallelism and so forth. Larger data sets. So secondly, these tasks are independent. I've been stressing this along the way, but the key to these tasks being independent or idempotent is that it's easy to handle partial failures. If a machine goes down midway through a job, you can simply rerun those map tasks, let's say, on those key value pairs. The system can just decide, well, gee, I haven't heard back from this mapper on this range of key value pairs. So let's run it again. And because the underlying system can coordinate, even if the machine was just slow and it comes back and it says, here, here, here are the answers, those can just be ignored. And the central system doesn't get confused, it just picks whatever answers come back most quickly. So from the system management point of view, this avoids all sorts of crawling horrors of trying to create a synchronous distributed system with lots of inter-node communication. Now, the synchronous, why am I setting that up as a straw man? Well, a synchronous system is the more natural generalization of what you're used to on individual machines, right? You're used to maybe now multiple cores and threaded programs on multiple cores. So, okay, let's treat these 1,000 machines as, you know, thousands of threads that are just distributed. It turns out that programming model is terrifyingly complicated in many applications. And so Hadoop MapReduce simplifies and just eliminates all that complexity. Furthermore, along the lines of partial failures, a machine doesn't need to fail for it to for a task to be rerun. If a machine is just slow, the central coordinating unit, the master node, can send out tasks again and do what's called speculative execution. So these many pairs can be sent out in parallel, and even if all the nodes are functioning, the master just takes whichever computer happens to give the results back first. And this actually speeds up jobs a lot, job completion. Because what typically ends up happening with these MapReduce jobs is all of the nodes are saturated for a long time, and then most of them are finished. So I'm plotting sort of utilization of your cluster. All of them are saturated for a long time, and then most of them are finished, but there are a few stragglers that are slow for whatever reason. And if you seed those jobs again, those key value pairs again, you can finish and compress that tail much more quickly. So another point is that in the ideal case anyway, Hadoop scales linearly. Now this is truly amazing. If you have a data set that is of size, you know, 1 petabyte, and now suddenly you want to increase it, you know, the web evolves and grows, or Facebook goes from 300 million users to 600 million users, and you have 2 petabytes, well, you just throw 2 times as many machines at it, and Hadoop should continue to function. In practice, there are limitations based on the architecture of Hadoop, but for a large regime, there is linear scaling behavior. Throwing more machines at it makes it go proportionally faster. And that's great because it's designed for cheap commodity hardware, so you don't have to buy these super reliable machines from Sun, because even those fail anyway if you have enough of them, and you have to plan in software for machines to fail, and as long as you're planning for machines to fail, you might as well work with cheaper hardware. It fails more often, but the software's handling it, so you don't care. Finally, the Hadoop programming model is really simple compared to other models for programming large sets of machines in parallel. The end user programmer only has to write these MapReduce tasks, like I was telling you before. You might only have to write a few small functions that you pass into the Hadoop framework, and all the rest of this gets taken care of for you. And the advantage of that is that the folks who are working on Hadoop, or at Google, the folks who are working on the MapReduce engine, can improve the engine, and then all of these programs benefit without the programmers having to do anything at all, because the interface doesn't change, and the interface is very simple. So those are some of the many advantages of learning how to use a toolkit like Hadoop. Of course, nothing's perfect. And especially in these early days, Hadoop is still rough around the edges. So here are some of the disadvantages that I've experienced personally working with Hadoop. The software is still under active development and doesn't have many of the features that, say, Google's implementation has, and doesn't have many features that you would think would be essential. For example, HDFS does not yet support append operations. So what that means is, suppose you write a file as the output of a MapReduce job to the Hadoop file system, and now you think, oh, okay, some new data's come in. Let's just append to the end. Well, you can't. even though that's the most natural thing that you'd want to be able to do, you have to start new files. You can work around this, right? You start new files, you know, you do these jobs in batch anyway, and then every so often you can merge these files together. So it's not that bad, but append would be really nice. The programming model is extremely restrictive. Like I said, you can't do all the things that you're used to doing. All these simplifications that make the thing work despite partial failure on large clusters of machines tie your hands a lot. And the lack of any kind of central data store that's available to all the map tasks at once can be very frustrating. You know, you might want to know, well, hey, I need to download the photos that I haven't seen yet. Well, evaluating haven't seen yet is a global operation that Hadoop is not designed to do quickly. And so there are workarounds again, but they're not always pretty and they're not always efficient. So as I mentioned before, joins of multiple data sets can be very tricky and slow because there are absolutely no indices. Now, there's work to build indices on Hadoop and it's not that difficult to do it yourself, but if you've been accustomed to working in the database world, for example, with SQL databases, you take indices for granted. Like, of course, I'm going to index this on the user ID or the photo ID or the, you know, record ID. And then records over here and records over there are going to get joined by matching up these record IDs. Well, in Hadoop, you basically have to run through and copy the entire data set across the map phase to the reduce phase often and sort the entire data set before you can filter down and decide which pairs of records you actually want to keep. There are some strategies for getting around this, but they're sort of outside the scope of this talk. Next, so cluster management is difficult, right? Even though Hadoop is handling a lot of the problems with programming multiple machines, you still have multiple machines there. And so debugging a Hadoop process is really tough. Distributing software is a little bit annoying, and collecting logs, right? They're spread across all these machines. And if you have enough machines, you may not even have the disk space on one local machine to collect all the logs and analyze them. So then all of a sudden, your log analysis has to become a MapReduce job as well. And so it's just a different way of thinking, and you have to be really comfortable with the tools to make it work. Hadoop is still single master, which means that if the master node fails, you're in trouble. There is a backup master node, and there are procedures you can follow to make Hadoop relatively high availability and relatively robust, but it's not quite at the point of instantaneous failover to a second machine that's perfectly up to date. Fortunately, an individual machine doesn't fail very often. The reason that failure is so commonplace in these large systems is because you have so many machines, and so the chances that one machine is going to fail among many are high. But the chances that that machine is going to be the master are low. So this is actually not so bad in practice. Managing job flow isn't trivial when you want to keep intermediate data. Now what that means is Hadoop has lots of abstractions to say, okay, do this map pass and this reduce pass. Feed the output of that into this map pass and do this second reduce pass. Feed the output of that and so forth. Yahoo, for example, has a pipeline of maybe 100 MapReduce passes to construct its web search index. But suppose along the way you want to keep some intermediate results. Maybe you want to restart the computation in the middle because the first part was still very expensive, even with your big cluster. All these abstractions aren't quite there yet. And so you're still doing a lot of manual management to say, OK, start here. Assume that all this has already been done, and then go from there. Finally, there's this issue that the optimal configurations of nodes are not obvious. When you're setting up Hadoop, you might have to specify, okay, how many mappers should run on this machine? How many reducers should run on this machine? How much memory should each map or reduce process get? And maybe your machines are heterogeneous because they've accumulated over time as you've added to your cluster. And there are some ways of doing that, but you're still doing a lot of it by hand in these configuration files. So Hadoop's not perfect, but it's improving fast under active development and actively supported by Yahoo and Cloudera, among others. So I hope a lot of these problems are going to go away. Finally, let me just tell you how to get started with Hadoop. I recommend that you go to cloudera.com. So Cloudera is a startup company that's trying to make it easier to work with Hadoop. They have a distribution of it that runs, that's easy to install on Debian Linux or Red Hat. You can run their virtual machine image on Amazon EC2. And they have lots of information in one place, and their employees are really active on the Hadoop mailing list. So if you get involved with Cloudera, join the Hadoop mailing list, you'll get a lot of support on how to actually make things work and benefit from the expertise of others. So check out cloudera.com. When you want to install Hadoop, you can either run Cloudera's virtual machine, so no installations other than that. You can run your own virtual machine. I recommend Ubuntu and VirtualBox, which is free. You can install Cloudera's distribution on your own machine, which means if you're running Linux, for example, or if you're running, Debian in particular, it's just apt-get install Hadoop. As I mentioned before, you can run Hadoop on EC2 either with Cloudera's AMI or with Amazon's Elastic MapReduce, which doesn't provide as much flexibility but might be easier. Or you can just download Hadoop directly from hadoop.apache.org and install it from source, compile it yourself. You won't get all the patches that Cloudera's put in, and so it might not be as up to date, but that's a perfectly reasonable way to go. Next, it's important to remember, as I mentioned before, that you have lots of language flexibility in working with Hadoop. It's written in Java, but the component called Hadoop Streaming allows mappers and reducers to be written in any language that can use standard in and standard out. So using standard in and standard out, which are text-oriented, makes it a little difficult to use binary data, but you could get around that with something like Base64 encoding, but there's a new entity called typed bytes, which is built into Hadoop, that makes it easier to pass binary data around, even to mappers and reducers that are written in a different language. For Python, I really recommend using a wrapper called Dumbo. The address for that is here, or you just Google Hadoop Dumbo and you'll find it. The Python word count example that I showed you before came with Dumbo, and it has several other example programs to show you how to do a join, for example. And in particular, so I work on large-scale face recognition. I work with lots of images. And I've really benefited from the fact that Dumbo makes binary data with typed bytes really easy. So finally, I'll leave you with just a few useful resources. As I mentioned before, the Hadoop homepage is hadoop.apache.org, and you can learn more about Hadoop there. Cloudera is great. I know a lot of the guys from Cloudera, and they're working really hard to make Hadoop more usable. Dumbo, again, is here. Amazon's EC2 is fantastic. You can rent machines by the hour and pay for only what you use, and use only what you need, without having to provision in advance and order machines 6 weeks before you think you might need them. These Elastic resources are really fantastic for variable size, large scale computation. And finally, my number one debugging tip is always test locally on a tiny data set before running on a cluster. Now, even though Hadoop is designed for big, large-scale data processing, you can configure it to run in sort of a dummy local mode where you can test your mappers and reducers, and that is a fantastic way to go. Iron all the bugs out of your mappers and reducers there before you try and run on the big data set on the cluster, because debugging on the cluster is just harder. And it's necessary, but you don't want to be ironing out simple bugs that you could have caught locally by SSHing around to multiple machines or collecting huge logs and trying to sift through them to catch simple problems. Finally, I'd like to thank you all for your attention, and I hope that you have a wonderful time with Hadoop. Thanks very much.